Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week wherever you are listening. Thank you so much for your, thanks for being here, okay? It's a show about grief and I appreciate that you are willing to download it and listen to it. Because not everybody wants to have these conversations. And I guess there's a lot of us in the club that do. So yeah, thank you for being here. I do have to mention it every week. I'm sorry, I feel like it's... I'm not going to apologise for it, okay? I'm just going to tell you. I have a book coming out. It's coming out in January. It's called You Are Not Alone. Because some people don't listen every week. Not like you. You listen every week. You're great. But some people, they're only, you know, downloading a few episodes here and there. So I'm just going to make sure I mention it. It's called You Are Not Alone. It's out in January, published by Bloomsbury Tonic. You can pre-order it now. I'm really proud of it. It's everything I've learned from doing this show for 6 years. And all the things that have come up again and again and again, all the life lessons that we've picked up from over 200 conversations of talking to people about grief and death, and I think you will find it useful if you're listening to this show. So if you would like to pre-order it, I'd be very grateful. Thank you. This week I'm talking to the very brilliant stand-up comedian and actor Isabel Farrer. Isabel is a hilarious person. She took a show up to Edinburgh right in the middle of all the pandemic, really, 2021, called Ellipsis, which was a kind of comedy sort of one-woman show about grief. And that's the show I've seen her do, Ellipsis, and I was so moved by it. It was such a wonderful, brilliant piece of theatre and comedy, but also dealing with grief in the way that only a griefster can. She took two shows up to Edinburgh this year, Ellipsis and her other stand-up show as well. As I said, she's an extremely funny, brilliant person. Now, I'm just going to say before we go into the conversation, this episode is about suicide, just as a trigger warning. So if that's something that you find difficult to listen to, this might be an episode that you want to skip over, or just to prepare you that that is what we are talking about today. Isabel came in to talk to me about her cousin, Jen. So, Isabel, who are we remembering today?
My cousin, Jen.
Your cousin, Jen. And how long ago did Jen die?
It's actually 5.5 years to the day.
To the day?
Yeah.
Wow. And it's funny, just from watching your amazing show, I know that you count quite specifically, the days and stuff. So, yeah, 5.5 years to the day. So, yeah, that's tough, isn't it, 5 years? It's, you're getting into the bit where, in other people's minds, it's quite far away.
Yeah. I think I definitely also feel like, because of the pandemic as well, that sort of marks a bit of a like change where I've had to, I think I was wallowing for quite a lot for the 3 years before. And then from March 2020, it was a bit like, wow, like life is changing quite drastically.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's quite far away now as well. you know, like yeah. thinking that she didn't live through this.
Yeah, I think your first big world event, like, that yeah. they didn't see. Like, I remember, it's a weird thing to say, but, like, so my dad died in 1998, and then I remember, like, the Twin Towers happening and being like, oh, he didn't know.
Yeah.
That's a massive thing. He has no idea it happened. How strange that, like, this sort of universal moment in history.
Yeah.
They weren't there to experience it, and it's, yeah, it's a weird... It's a weird sensation, but yeah,
definitely,
especially
yeah.
something like what we've just been through,
yeah.
to know that, yeah, they missed it is, it's just weird, isn't it? And do you mind talking about how she
no,
died?
No, not at all, no. I think no. it's really important, actually. Mm. So Jen died by suicide at the beginning of 2017, and she'd attempted suicide before, which I think is, like, I've since looked quite a lot at the stats and things, and I think if someone's attempted suicide, they are, it's something like 65% likely to die by suicide within a year afterwards.
Wow.
So I now have, like, a really big thing about, like, suicide prevention and look at, like, well, I mean, not in depth, it's not my job, but in, like, what those precursors are, what the warning signs are, and how society needs to change to help people through.
So you said she had tried before. Had she... So. I know
yeah.
from your show. So she was basically the same age as you, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, we were born, I think, like 2.5 or 3 weeks apart.
Wow.
So we were super, super close in age. And our mums are only like something like 16 months apart as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I talk about this in the show as well, but like growing up with those like milestones and like GCSEs in the same year. And I think we're also 2 of 11 cousins, which is quite large for a British family. So I just remember being a teenager and like watching other people do like GCSEs, A-levels, and then going to uni and stuff, and then, you know, us hitting those marks at the same time. And obviously, like, it sort of separates out in your 20s when you go different paths and things, and she went a little bit off the rails. And I think it's probably also important to say she'd had addiction issues, and she had quite like really severe mental health issues as well. So she had paranoid schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder. So but big hitters, you know.
Yeah. She was collecting the main cards in the mental health.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh God, that's really, really hard.
Yeah,
it's really hard with something like that, with like you said, with, you know, existing mental health conditions and knowing the resources that are currently available for our poor beleaguered NHS. Like, it's a very tough situation for someone to find themselves in, because obviously it's no one's fault that they have those mental health issues, and yet the support they might need in this country at the moment it's very hard to navigate. I've talked on the show before, like, I got therapy through the NHS. I was really lucky, but I was also really privileged, and like I knew what I needed to do.
Yeah.
Like,
there's that.
And I didn't take no for an answer for 3 years. I just kept coming back and being like, no, like, I've done 6 sessions of CBT. What next? What next? And it wasn't until sort of speaking to people afterwards, I was like, oh yeah, I guess it was quite confident and bullish to just keep going back.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have severe mental health issues. I just knew I really needed help with this grief.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I just really need help. But to approach the system with genuine mental health issues is a really tricky, really tricky place to navigate.
I think also the balance of like talking therapies and drugs and all of the things, and how you can manage that, like, with someone who's really, really ill, I think is really difficult. And she never had any therapy, and she refused. She did have a lot of support, and she spent some time in prison, so she had like also I don't remember what the word is, but like a parole officer or something, or, you know, people helping her through who were like also trying to stop her from ending up back in prison. So, and a big family as well, but there's only so far things really can go, I think.
Yeah, and we've talked about that on the show before in terms of suicide. It's like, it's a sort of the most clearest way you can realise how actual how individuals we all are.
Yeah.
That if somebody wants to do something, they can. Like, yeah. However much you love them,
yeah,
and are there for, and all that, you know, they could have every resource available to them, and you know, they can still make that choice. That is
yeah.
what humans can do, and it's sort of a really a horrible lesson to have sort of thrust upon you, like, oh,
yeah.
people can do what they want to do, essentially.
I think I really struggled because she'd attempted suicide the year before, and I'd spoken to her when she was in hospital, and we'd sort of thought that she might find her way out of the hole she was in.
Yeah.
And she'd started uni and things, and so she, you know, quite late, she was 30.
Wow.
And I'm so proud of her, I'm just going to say this. She'd gone to uni having not got A-levels, and so she'd gone back to college at like 27 or something, and she was going to convert her like foundation degree into a BA or BSc in aerospace engineering.
Wow.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just remember being like, fuck, she's going to be an aero... Like, I'm a clown. She's she's really turning her life around. And I was
yeah.
so... We all were, like, just so proud of her. And she got through a term of uni. And I think that probably just contributed to a huge sense of isolation for her. I think she found uni really overwhelming. So... Yeah, I think that's partly when she died, I felt this quite big, like, oh, I didn't see, I'd seen warning signs before, I didn't see those, like, I wasn't there enough for her, like, and I think also, and I've spoken about this with a few people, but I remember realising how ill she was in about, I think, 2012 or 13, and she'd gone into, like, this massive spiral, and she'd been at my parents' house, and I'd walked with her to the station, because my mum had been like, don't let her out of your sight until we know that she's being picked up by someone at the other end. So I'd just gone down this really long walk around a park. So I don't think she noticed, but I'd like double backed on us and like all this stuff. And she, just as she left, her friend had called her and she was going to meet her friend. And just as she left, she like turned around to me and she like pulled me in and hugged me so hard. And she lifted weights and she was really strong, so she like pulled me in so hard and she was like, Izzy, my head's so fucked up and I just don't know what to do about it. And that the feeling of like not being able to do anything about that and knowing that there's something happening that I can't fathom in that person's
yeah.
head. And I remember thinking to myself, like, that there will never be a point when I'm not going to have to go, I have to deal with that. Like, if she's
yeah.
even when we're 50 or 60 and, you know, my parents aren't around, or like, you know, she's got siblings as well, but that I knew that I'd be part of that core. And I just remember thinking, like, this person is partly my responsibility now forever.
Wow.
And so I think working through that in therapy, I remember thinking, like, that responsibility or the sense of responsibility that I felt afterwards really stems back to like that point when I was like, right, well, take it, that's it, she's your family, you can't absolve yourself of that responsibility at any point. Like, there'll be points when you can go like, actually I can't pick this up right now, but let me see into like
yeah.
how can I help. But yeah, so I think I can really really trace that back. And I think also when it's like a sibling or someone who's like your age, and I did feel that like parallelness about why did she end up with that and I didn't?
Yeah.
Like, how, at what point did things split? Or, you know, like I have anxiety and I have like quite low mood sometimes, but I don't, you know, I've never been suicidal. And I think the unfairness really hit me.
Yeah, it's hard when it's such a comparison, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I imagine you spent your childhood slightly being compared, because you can't
yeah.
help when there's cousins close together and it's like, oh, wow, oh, they're this tall.
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
definitely.
They like this. Do they like that as well? Oh, because it's just what families do. And yeah, like, I imagine as kids, it was just, you know, normal comparison. And then, like you said, when's the point where it's like, oh, this person is not
yeah.
well. Like, this person is very different. This person isn't living the same reality that we're all living.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think it's quite hard, I can imagine it's quite a hard shift when that person has been in your, like,
yeah.
your Venn diagram, for want of a better word, like she's been in your circle. Like, yeah, we're the same. We're this age. We like watching this and we like eating this. And they're like, whoa, hang on. Now she's like separating it. Yeah. It's hard. It must be very hard and very painful to have the before and after, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think also, because we sort of became, kind of didn't see her that much, kind of probably between the age of about 17 and 22 or 23. And then she came clean. So she stopped taking drugs and stopped drinking and started doing like a chef course. And then she was sort of exploring. It was like quite an amazing thing watching someone in their 20s, like looking at like all the options of like what life held. Mm. And so I think that, and she was always felt quite wide eyed, like, because she lived in like a village in Somerset. And so she'd come up to London and be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, she'd be like, can we go and watch a musical? Because she went to a musical for the first time or something at like 24. She was obsessed with Queen. And so we'd gone to watch We Will Rock You, and she, actual full on like tears at the end when this hologram of Freddie Mercury came up. And she'd be like, oh my God, Freddie! And so it was such a joy to be around her in her 20s. Like, she just was, there was just so much that she was kind of learning about the world and like, and seeing. And she'd started running marathon or like half marathons and like lifting weights and things, and then discovering like what she wanted to do with her life. And so watching all of that was an incredible journey. And so it felt, when she died, obviously there was that lack of that potential stopped, and I was sort of so devastated that there was so far she could have gone, and she didn't make it.
So hard, isn't it? It's so, and like we've, you know, when talking about suicide before, it's just like that added layer, I think, on top of the grief. But it's like someone's sprinkling more pain onto grief, which is already a fucking nightmare. Because when someone dies young, you know, we all feel that pain. Oh, they could have done this. And oh, it's so sad. It's so sad. Like, or, you know, they got cancer and they just died. Like, but when with suicide, it's that aching, like you said, of just like, but they are like... I feel like you want to reach into their brain and be like, no, you're not allowed to do that. That's not right. That's not what you're meant to do. But it, like we've said before, you can't stop people from making the choices they make. But that's a really hard thing to weigh with the grief as well. And we've said that before on the show that it's grief plus.
It's not Olympics.
You know? No,
but it's not a competition.
It's not a competition, and there is no hierarchy. I just mean that it's like there's something else. It's like it's not better or worse. It's just extra, is what I mean. Like there's just something that like people just grieving have all this shit to deal with, and then like with suicide, there's just like another box.
Yeah,
it's like actually you have to take that as well. Sorry, like, and you can't leave it here.
I think also like I. Because also when you tell people that your cousin's died, people are like, oh my God, was she ill? And they're anticipating cancer, and you're like, and I can feel myself being like, oh God, I'm going to have to explain it. But as soon, if you said cancer, they'd be like, oh, what kind of, my uncle had bowel cancer. Yeah, and you'd be like, okay, fine, sure. But if you say she died by suicide, or she killed, I mean, I don't mind saying she killed herself. People find that quite like violent. Yeah. But if you say she died by suicide, there's just this like, oof, I can feel it. Like people are so stunned and they don't know what to say. And then you're like, oh, now I've got to manage your feelings about it. And I just, a lot of the time I don't want to, like, I don't want to watch someone's face like rearrange. And it, like, I just prefer you to go, oh my God, that's really tough. I don't know what to say.
And I was talking, I was another guest, and we were saying that feeling of watching someone's face is so awful. But actually, I was thinking about it, and my theory is when you're living with your own pain, it's like you don't really look at it, it's just there.
Yeah.
But what you're seeing is somebody reflecting back at you how painful your life is. And that's makes you feel sick. Because you know what I mean? Because you go, oh, they're reacting like that's agony, but that's my life, that's my day to day. I don't, and it's that, it's sort of, they sort of
because they're just giving you one moment, do you know what I mean? Like, your life isn't agony every single second of the day. It's just like they give you that reaction. And I think that's why, as grievers, we find it really irritating. She's like, yeah, I know. Don't show me.
I know
me.
It's shit. Like,
yeah. Put that, rearrange your face into, like you said, oh gosh, that's very hard.
Yeah.
And I do think suicide, you know, we've come so far in talking about death. There's still a long way to go, but suicide still just, people just absolutely freak out. They just don't know what to say. Which, I understand we're not practicing it. We don't talk about it at school. There's not enough, there's lots of, mental health. But no one's like, hey, so some people will take their own lives. Yeah. How would we talk to someone who had experienced the loss? Like, nobody's having those conversations.
No.
And so I think people just absolutely freak out. Like, they just don't know what to say.
I mean, there's still such shame around it that, like, it's almost seen as a weakness.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think because we don't talk about, like, if there's still, like, euphemisms around it and, like, I think took their life, I always find a bit like, did she take it?
Yeah, that's true. It's a bit like... lost, isn't it, when you're like, I lost my dad. I didn't lose him, but I've never thought about that before. Took their own life, it's like, well, where did they take it? Where did they take it to the place where it wasn't there? You're right, it's a weird, it's still a euphemism, isn't it?
And I think also the fact that people don't realize that it's committed suicide still implies that it's a crime. I mean, I think you've spoken about this before, but it still implies that it's a crime, and it's not. And it's, people get so funny about me saying killed herself, and they're like, oh god, it just jars a little bit. I'm like, she did, sorry. Like,
yeah I mean, she did. And actually, like, the more we are honest about this situation, perhaps it's easier to understand your pain and her pain, because we're minimizing it, aren't we? She took her life. It's like, she went to Sainsbury's. Like, it doesn't sound real. Whereas even you saying she killed herself, it's like, that's what she did. That's why I'm in so much pain, because this person I loved killed themselves. Like, that is really painful. And again, I think that's what people are running away from, of like, that sounds awful. And you're like, it was. Like, it is. But we sidestep it so much. And I said this before on the show, but it wasn't until I started this podcast that I even realized that, because my whole life had been spent going, oh, my dad died when I was 15. Oh god, that was so young. Yes, it was young. What did he die of? Cancer. Oh god. And I had never envisioned the conversation of, you know, what you're talking about, being like, what? Oh, I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah.
I signed up to give you. Oh gosh, how sad. Cancer took him so young. It's so sad.
Like, particularly at the moment, I think now that I've written a show about it, and I think because when it got reviewed last year, it suddenly became a little bit easier, and not like, oh, it's buzzed on this really weird, like, thing where she's like living in her grief like years and years.
Hey, welcome to the club. I see nothing wrong with that behavior.
No, but like, honestly, meeting new people and they're like, oh, what do you do? Oh, that's fantastic. Like, have I seen anything? And I'm like, no, but my show was on at Edinburgh last year and it did quite well. And they're like, oh, is it a comedy show? And I'm like, well kind of.
Little bit.
I was on a date with this guy last year, and he was like, oh, what's it about? And I was like, grief. And he was like, Greece, as in the
playoffs. Yeah, it's just like, all about Greece and the holiday I went on. It's hilarious.
My 50 favourite kinds of oil.
Oh my god. I mean, I still get that, like, so... Yeah, often I meet people who have no, like, obviously I'm not famous, and they'll have no idea of
anything. You are in my world.
Oh, thanks, Isabel. Thank you. I'll take it. But you know, like, they don't. It's people who don't watch any form of comedy at all. Like, it's like, even if you said like, oh, QI, they're like, oh, I've heard of that. And like, okay. they don't like laughing. That's what I feel. Like, they're not into it, which is fine. It's not for everyone. And like, I'll just say, oh, what do you mainly do? Oh, I do a podcast. Oh, right, what's it about? It's always taxi drivers as well. I'm like, grief? It's about grief and death. And you could just see they're like, what? Why? And again, it's such a test, isn't it? Because sometimes people, like you said in your brilliant, brilliant show, sometimes people are like, oh my God, this just happened to me. Wow, somebody wants to talk about, like, the relief. You see their shoulders drop and they're like, oh, actually, I just lost so-and-so. And gosh, I'd love to see that. Or they're like, all right. And they're just like, absolutely. I had this guy in Glasgow who was just like, have you, after I said grief and death, he went, have you, do you read true crime? And I was like, not really. And he was like, let me tell, I love true crime. And he just went on for 20 minutes about his favourite true crime and the authors he'd met. And I was like, wow, he panicked so badly. It's all he could think of was like, oh, that's death as well. Like, it's like fiction, but, or non-fiction, obviously. But that was his like, oh, I know about grief and death because I've read true crime. I was like, wow. And obviously I'm like, of course I haven't read true crime. I do a podcast about grief and death. I don't need to read these horrific stories. Yeah, it's a weird place to put yourself to yeah. go, I'm someone who's actually going to really, really talk about this.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Let's talk about the show.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I have only seen it on an online recording, but it was, yeah. Obviously, we've been talking about the show. We had messaged each other, so I kind of I knew what it was about. But I was like, oh wow, like she's you, because you have done that thing using comedy whilst talking about something very, very serious and making it like palatable for the audience. And so you took that to Edinburgh last year.
Yeah.
But what you said in the show, so that it's interesting, you started writing it in 2018.
Yeah.
So that was just a year after she died.
It was 18 months.
18 months, right.
I remember, so it, just before she died, I'd kind of been in this really funny place where I was an actor and I just started doing comedy and I was like, I'm going to do something else. I need to like just switch things up because it wasn't really working. And it was the year that Chewing Gum and Fleabag come out and I was like, I just have to write a show. I was like, there's no way around it. You just have to write your own show. Otherwise, like you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And in a weird turn of events, I was in a co-op agency, which is where you have to work one day a week. And I was like, no, that day's coming back to me and I need that day to write. And my final day in my agency was the day after she died. And I was like, when I left, I was like, right, in 2 months, I'm going to have a new agent and I'm going to be doing all of this stuff and I'm going to write a new short film. And so she died and I had just been like, I just didn't give a fuck. I didn't care about like writing. I carried on trying to like write to casting directors and be like, hi, I'd love to come and audition for this, blah, blah. And I really would turn up to auditions being like, what you want, what from me?
Yeah.
And I just left everything for a bit and I didn't push trying to get a new agent. I did some comedy. I sort of pushed it again from October, but I really wasn't able to focus on anything. And then I think on the anniversary, I remember being like, oh, okay, you've got to pick yourself up a bit more. And I started doing comedy a bit more. And then in, I think June or July, and I found the WhatsApp messages where I sent to like a group with two other actors that I know, I've known for like years from doing a show with them. And I said, guys, I think I'm going to write a show where it's me on stage, but there's like living a difficult time, but like also with like voiceover of like conversations with my therapist, or reading the notes that I wrote. So I would write myself these notes on my phone about her death in the year after she died, like, and it was generally on the anniversary or on like the 12th of each month. And so I was like, maybe I'll record those and like put them in, but you're never quite sure what's happened, and like make it sort of verbatim but also like really abstract. And I was envisioning this like really like weird comedy hybrid, like groundbreaking piece of art. It's now just a very classic one woman show. And so I started.
And all the easier to watch for it, I would say. As amazing as that sounds, we all sat through that one woman show and gone, oh God, what's happening?
Yeah.
So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed your traditional take
on
the one woman show.
Phew.
Yeah.
And then, so I started writing it mid-2018. That's when I started planning it. And I think I wrote 20 minutes in September or October 2018. And then I had the first full draft out in December 2018.
Wow.
And then I sort of tried to rework it a little bit. So I was like, right, well, if I show this, I basically switch between being on a mic and off a mic all the way through. So you know clearly when I'm doing stand-up and when I'm not. So I did that from first draft one, and then I was like, oh, maybe I'll try and wrench this into, because I know where the laughs are, maybe I can wrench it into like a stand-up show, and so you don't know so anyone's died or what's going on until like act four or whatever, you think of a four act structure. And then I tried to do stand-up about it, and I was like, oh God, no, like absolutely not, this is it's awful. And I think it's also worth noting that in the first work in progress I changed the name. I was like, I called myself Roz and was like, oh, my name's Roz, and but so much of it is me, and I was like, well, then I have artistic license to change any details if I want to.
Yeah,
but then I was like, you know what, this is me, it's my voice, it's my life, it's my cousin, like, no, it's, and it meant that I felt quite a bit funny about authorship and about genre. This is a very hack conversation, but because I wasn't sure then, like, I was like, is it comedy? Is it theatre? Is it, what is it? And what am I trying to do with this? And then I just had to kind of remove those questions and be like, write it, make it. It's a piece of theatre. It's a show. And then if people don't like it because of what it is or what it isn't, then as long as I do.
Yeah. I think it's storytelling, is it? And actually, you know, when you talk about Chewing Gum and Fleabag and all of these shows, which, you know, I love, and I love this movement of shows that aren't like set up punchline, with characters that do things that you don't believe in, because it'd be funny if they went to the toilet and the lid fell off and then the builder came round, and like all that kind of 90s sitcom that we grew up with. Like, imagine if that happened. And now we're into this really truthful, authentic voice, which I know some people find like, where are the bloody jokes? And you're like, yeah, but I do love hearing people's stories. Like, that's what I think a lot of what the movement before, and like why Fleabag was so successful, like, was this lack of story. It was just all about situation and characters. And wouldn't it be funny if, you know, three priests lived on their own and this happened? Whereas now it's like, wouldn't it be heartbreaking and funny and true if this person stood up and said, hey, this happened to me? And this is a very in-depth comedian conversation, but I think it annoys some people because you kind of have to have a story. And there is that joke of the dead dad show in Edinburgh. Oh, they're just doing their dead dad show. And I can see both sides, obviously, like, it's annoying of like everybody does stand up about death and that becomes,
do you know,
a genre
what's more
in
annoying is when everybody just does stand up.
Yeah, exactly.
I love stand up. I love doing stand up. But do you know what? If you've got a whole month of just watching people like wrap their life into neat little punchlines and not a single tear, I'm like, oh God, no.
Yeah. And I think especially the time we're living in, it's like you need this, like, your heart has, like, we live in such tough times. You want someone else to be like, me too.
Yeah.
I am also living in tough times. And this is how I worked my way through it. And grief isn't linear, but shows require a linear narrative. And something in that is satisfying. To watch you piece your way through, you know, dealing with your grief and dealing with the grief of a suicide and sort of just finding your way through this new situation, as an audience, you're like, oh, perhaps we can all find our way through the situation. How did you find, like, so I did a lot of character comedy where it was like totally hidden, like the grief was like buried seven layers deep, which I didn't really realise I was doing. And I did think about you, because, you know, like you said, you're using your own name, you're talking, like, you're saying my cousin killed herself, like it's very on the surface of like the truth. Is it hard to do that every single day, like, especially in Edinburgh? Were there moments you're like, because I have moments with the podcast, I'm like, why did I do this to myself? Like, were you in Edinburgh going, why did I do this? Like, I have to say she's dead every single day. Or was that a part of it that you enjoyed, of like, I get to say this?
I think Edinburgh was oddly easier. And I think it was partly because the show was at 4:15, and so I'd come out, and also there was no bar, like, so the restrictions were still like happening last summer, and so there was no bar there. I would walk out, I'd take my hair down, put my glasses on, put a mask on, walk out, and people would be like, "Did you? Was that just you?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, thanks," and literally be like, "I'm just walk off into the sunset, basically." I then did it at the Soho for 3 nights, and that was so whirlwind that I just really enjoyed it. And then in February I did it at Pleasance, and it was like 7:30 in the evening, and it was midwinter, and I think, because I was getting the bus like home to my like where I live, it all felt quite day to day and mundane, and I really struggled in February. Like, I had a real low that week, and I think I was on Woman's Hour that week as well. And if there's anything that's quite public, I get quite a lot of suicide trauma into my DMs.
Yes.
And it's like, I can deal with lots of things, but I've had to mute the word hanged in my Instagram inbox, because people just... And I can completely understand why they do it. Like, it's just that we're so silenced about grief and so silenced about suicide that people are like, oh my God, she seems... like she's got her shit together, and I'm just going to tell her, so, because I just need to let it out. But my poor little heart, like, sometimes I think that I'm fine doing it, and because I've scripted it, and I also know when I can almost, oh God, I feel very bad saying this, but sometimes I can really phone in that show.
Of course, just, after that, like, many times doing it, and that's protection as well. Like, absolutely. This show's a hard show to do. If you like wrenched your heart out every night, like, you know, that is a one woman drama show. There's not that, you know, so you do have to like put your barriers up and go, like, this is the sad bit, here we go, strap in first gear, like, off we go.
So I feel like I had opened myself up quite a lot that week, and then quite a lot of stuff came back to me, and I was a bit like, whoa, I really need to. And so I ended up, like, I wouldn't have ever dreamt of doing this normally, but like, I got one of my best friends to come and watch. I comped her in. And I was like, can you just come and sit with me in the dressing room afterwards? Like, I just, I don't want to go into the bar. I just want to be able to sit and, like, take my time. One of the other things I've discovered doing it, because, like, I've been an actor and just used to being in dressing rooms from, like, half an hour before the show. And then, like, if you're coming on and off stage, you've always got, like, people to interact with. And when you go and do a show on your own for an hour, you turn up, no one's telling you what time to turn up before, which I've had to be my own stage manager and be like, right, be there for the half, Isabel, because you can't waltz in 10 minutes before. And then you go on stage, you give for an hour. It's not tiring. It's not physically tiring for me. It's not, but I give for an hour, and then I come off stage and there's no one to go, oh, that went all right. Oh, did you fuck up that bit? Oh, God. Yeah, I know. But did you see that person? All of those little things that just human contact-wise you get from doing a play with another person, I get none of that. And so at the end, I really have to be like, right, what do I need right now in this moment?
It's really lonely. And it sounds like a silly thing to say, but like, having done many a one-woman show, like, it's so lonely. Yeah. And that's why I kind of gave it up, and that's why I still do Ostentatious, because I walk off stage and there's five people
glorious
five people going, oh my God, that was so funny, did you see that, oh my God, when you said that, oh, that was good, that was hard, wasn't it, I didn't know why you were gonna do that. And that feeling of connection, like, I am addicted to that. I am absolutely addicted to that. And like, ostentatious improv has been like the constant in my whole performance life. Mm. Whereas the one-man show, even when I was just doing like pure comedy, it wasn't even, you know, there was nothing in it that you would have noticed. I'd walk off and just, like you said, that feeling of like, and I did feel for you because what you're talking about is so personal. And I mean, I have the same thing. It's the tension of the world we live in, of like, you want to be someone that is talking about it, is normalizing it. That's really great. But then, like you said, you're giving that out, but you're not in control of what comes back to you, which, no. You know, I similarly get sometimes really, really difficult DMs or emails that I feel so overwhelmed with. Obviously, listeners, I love being contacted and I love people saying, thank you for the show, I want to tell you my story. But there's a difference between...
Yeah.
I know what you're describing, somebody who hasn't spoken about it and gives you like the full graphic detail of what happened to them. And often you're like, oh, this needed a therapist or a doctor. Like this needed somebody to contain this. I'm a performer. I'm not that person. But because I'm willing to stand up and share my story, like you said, everyone, and I can imagine with suicide, it, you know,
and there's totally not many people talking about it. Like, I don't ever want to be like...
It's not don't do it, it's so annoying. It's like, oh, there's two truths about this. Like, I'm so glad that I'm able to be this position, but also it's very painful when I have to read these things that I'm just not prepared for in any sense or shape. I've gone on Instagram to look at my mate's holiday picture and I'm like, oh my God. Like... And it is, that's what I mean about the tension of social media. It's like everything's in the same room. Like everything is in the room. Like, and where I feel like I am older than you, but what we grew up with was more like you'd ring your friend and she'd tell you, or you'd go around and see her photos, and then you might see someone else, you'd be like, oh, this thing happened to me. Like you were able to move between spaces.
Yeah.
And we don't have that anymore.
No, not at all. And I think also the tension of like, at the moment, I'm really feeling that, like, trying to build a following and trying to make sure that, like, people can come and find my gigs and come and find my shows. Yeah, and you're like, right, so I have to be really present and online all the time and chirpy. And then sometimes you're like, yeah, but also can you not... Like, the backside of that is that I don't want... No, please don't slide into my DM. Like,
It's a really tricky, like, line to manage because, like, same. I feel like I don't want people to feel like they can't send me a message and can't say, you know, this helped me or this was useful. It's just...
There's a really fine line, isn't it? And I can't, like... Because I get quite a lot, but I've also just had, like, some people being like, hey, I just watched your show and, like, my brother died last year and you articulated a lot. That's what I've had quite a lot of, is people saying like, you articulated stuff I've not really been able to, which is always like, oh fab, I'm really pleased that it was universal, because what I didn't want to make was a totally selfish show, like, either. So I am pleased that I can articulate it. It's just and I think that's, I guess there's something about, like, I don't talk about how Jen died. And if people ask me now, and they do, like, and like, it's just something you can't...
Well, I learned that for doing this show. Yeah. That the etiquette is not to... Like, I was stupid. Like, so how did it happen? And my friend Jen, who lost her brother to suicide, was whoa, Carrot. I've known Jen for, like, years and years. And she was like, you don't ask that. And I was like, oh, I did not know. Yeah. And she was like, yeah, that's not cool, mate. So I went to,
I think,
uni,
we're just
Jen,
given so just, much voyeuristic detail of, like, everything that happens. And we're so used to that, like, just intimate details of absolutely everything, that it doesn't occur to you that you shouldn't do it.
And but it's weird. I would feel like that with cancer. Like, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, how did you die? And I'll say, oh, pancreatic cancer. And then normally it's like, oh yes, that's quite bad, or I know someone who had that. But then I've had people go, oh, right, so where was it? Where did it start? Well, how long do you have treatment for? And I'm like, are you a fucking doctor? Like, why do you need to know? He's dead.
Did he have secondaries? No, I don't
know. Yeah. And like, I've had someone, and I feel like sometimes it's people trying to play it cool. So I'm cool with this. I'm going to ask you loads of stuff. And you're like,
good for you. I'm not.
Yeah. And I never forget, I spoke to the amazing Poona Bell, who...
Oh, yeah.
Lost her husband to suicide. Apologies, I'm saying lost, I'm just looking for the right
words. It's fine, I'm
not always getting them right. And her episode is really, like, I found really interesting and moving in terms of talking about suicide, that she was at a breakfast meeting And somebody asked about her husband and she had to say, oh, he actually took his own life. And the woman with that beat was like, oh, how did he do it? At a breakfast meeting. And she was like, and she said the people she was with bristled, like, but this other woman was just like, oh, I'm allowed to ask that. And she eloquently and beautifully said, as she's so yeah, wonderfully expressing herself, said, you know, that's not an appropriate question.
I mean, aside from what you're putting that person through who's gone yeah, through it, but secondly, does the whole room want to know?
Exactly. I think it is like this idea, and I think it almost does come from, like you said, true crime,
yeah,
voyeurism. Like, we're used to being like, oh, how did she get murdered? Like, oh, tell me the deep, which I never want details.
No.
I don't want to know. But
it's also, it's really dark. Like, if you think that through, like, because, and I've got a really overactive imagination, and like, if you tell me one detail, yeah, my mind has built every other. It's asking me, like, yeah, what the sound on the floor, what, you know, all of those. It doesn't matter yeah, who it was or what it was or how far away it was. Like, I've had to go through the detail in my head. Yeah. And so sometimes when someone says something, I've got a message about something, and my head had that image
yeah,
in it for like 2 days
yeah,
and it was like, oh God, please don't do this to me. And yeah, I think another thing that's quite interesting is that Jen did use the same method as her friend had, like, 2 months before.
Oh.
And so there is a thing about copycat, like, yeah, suicides, which I think is another reason why we have to address it a little bit more carefully. Like,
yeah,
you don't want to talk about the way someone's done it, because if another person in the room is in any way feeling like, oh, I'm on the brink, giving them the extra possibility of knowing what or where or how yeah, might just tip them into, oh, and I don't want to be morbid about it,
no,
but you
no,
don't know
true,
what the state of people's heads are around you. And I just think, I think of myself now as like cushioning like my knowledge. And so I'm not that I don't want to seek things out, but just go like, okay, I don't need that darkness, because I don't yeah, want to open up a whole new level of darkness into my head at the moment. And I think, like, I'm feeling quite robust at the moment, but like in February, March, after doing the show again, I remember just being like, right, you're in like protectionist mode. So like anything that's too difficult, not talking about.
You have to protect yourself when yeah, you are being open and vulnerable. And I definitely had that with this show. Like, I remember thinking, I was just doing like the second season, it was right at the beginning. And I was like in a room with someone interviewing them and feeling like all of my grief, like suddenly like rising yeah, to the surface, and being like, oh God, what have I done? Like, I'm not ready to do. And it's just about, yeah, if you are someone who is willing to be open about your grief, like, how do you manage it? And I think yeah, you did, like, it sounds like you were amazingly self-aware to be like, I need my friend, you're going to come.
Yeah.
This is what I need, this is what I'm going to do. And that's all you can do is manage it. And I mean, so how do you, Isabel, solve it for us. What do you think, what can people do in terms of supporting someone with suicide? I know there's no like right or wrong answer, but like, if you know someone who, you know, has lost someone to suicide, like yeah, is there, like, what would you have wanted? And obviously it's very personal. Other people would have felt differently. There's,
I think,
never like
partly just acknowledging it. I can yeah, tell you which friends didn't even, like, yeah, didn't say a word.
Ugh.
Like, genuinely. And some people deal with grief in different ways, but like, I do remember being like, that person has not even said to me, like, are you okay? Or
yeah,
I think I remember noticing after a month people dropping off a little bit. And that I hit a really, really bad stage at like 3 or 4 months. And I had quite a normal day job at the time as well. And I was signed off sick. I probably had like quite severe insomnia for, I reckon, 6 or 7 months. And I still don't sleep well. Like, having been a notoriously good sleeper.
Oh, right.
And like, yeah, would sleep through absolutely anything. I now probably average like five or six hours a night. And I wake up once or twice, usually. Which is a big, I think in my 30s, I'm like, oh God, I really could have done with like I'm very tired these days. I really could do with not waking up at 4 a.m. Yeah. and being like, oh, I'm wide awake. But I think just keeping checking in on people after that first month, because I think I thought I'd be fine after, or like getting towards being fine, like the funeral's done, you've bookended it, like done, bye-bye. Keep a note. The anniversary still knocks me for... I know you talk about it a lot on the podcast, but like, it knocks me for six, and it's a tough... It's January the 12th, and it's 4 days after my birthday, and it's like in the darkest period of the year, and it's like the shit week when you're like, I'm really tired and hungover and I've got no money. Like, I remember in lockdown 3, so just after, in January 2021, when we'd just been like gone back into it, that week, and it was also the week that like Capitol Hill had been invaded by like some fascists. Yeah. Really bad COVID deaths. And I remember like the anniversary came, and I think my flatmate was possibly at her boyfriend's that night, and I think just remember being like on my own in the flat, like I got a takeaway, and I just remember being like, this is so shit, I can't even acknowledge it.
I can't even
this is anniversary 4 and I like I've lost my career, people are dying everywhere, there's fascism's on the rise, and I can't even leave the house and just go for like 2 glasses of wine in the local pub. I know that seems so mad, but like I'd just love to be around 10 people right now, and it's like it's illegal and irresponsible of me to do that. So whereas this year I felt like, God, sorry, I've got a bit tearful.
That's all right. It's all right.
On the anniversary this year, like I went for lunch with 2 friends, and then I went and watched 2 shows in the evening, and I was able to just like, I just remember being, even though it was like January and it was cold, I was like, just being out of the house and around people felt like almost euphoric because I was able to like really celebrate life, even though it was like 5 years after she died, and it's still a very strange time, and it's still a difficult era for us all, but I just remember being like, oh thank fuck I'm not like
alone. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, like I felt that so desperately in the lockdowns, because you know I know how isolating grief is, and I kept thinking about people fresh grieving, and I kept thinking, oh god, like imagine if you had to do this now, like and I know like the first lockdown a lot of people said, oh you know, it's very peaceful, and I actually had time to think about it, and I can see, you know, the weather was good, and you could go for a walk and stuff. But yeah, that third lockdown, I have a really old friend who lives in Mexico, but is, you know, grew up here. And I was trying to describe to her how bad that third, like, because she was like, oh, you know, it's another lockdown. I was like, you don't understand. This is the bleakest time I've ever experienced. And like, I feel Victorian levels of bleakness right now. Like, I have never felt like this. You know, it felt, you know, it was like Christmas Carol before he, you know, before he changes. Like, like you're just so cold, and Bob Cratchit, that's what I felt like. I felt like Bob Cratchit, like with one candle, just trying to like survive in life. And to have that plus grief, plus dealing with, like you talk about in the show, all the guilt and the other grief excrements of suicide. Like, it must have been so bleak. And just to be able, like you said, that... like you did the right thing and not going anywhere, but it doesn't mean that's not like hideously painful to try and deal with an anniversary and a grief when we couldn't see people. Like, it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot. You know, you said today is 5.5 years. Like it's, it's just hard. It's just hard.
Yeah.
Some days are easier and some days are fine and some days are not fine. And
I think also with the anniversary, and I couldn't work out why I was so obsessed with it. Like, and I think I remember thinking, if I get to a year, then I was like, but it's arbitrary. It's just, it's numbers. January is a human construct. Mm. Like the world's been in existence for years and years before January was a thing. But I think there's something about the time of year and like the light in the sky and like what the memory of those things as well, because there is that, you know, that thing of like low slung sun in January as it's like setting and all of that, or like potential that it might snow and like where the temperature sits. And so then the familiarity of not the date, but like the season.
Yeah.
And so I think it's partly that as well, that why we kind of come full circle with dates and things.
Well, there's that phrase, isn't it, that which I've said before, but I love it, that you have to pass through each season without them.
Yeah.
Which is actually what I think we've translated that as a year. A year makes a difference.
Yeah.
But actually, I think somewhere primarily, we have to go through each season with them.
Yeah.
So they didn't see the sun. They didn't see the leaves.
Yeah.
They didn't see the snow. Like, they're dead. Like, your brain is processing it. And I can really understand... January, yeah, I thought you were saying about January is really beautiful because it is such a specific light and feeling,
yeah,
and also quite a big potential, like the year's beginning. And that must relate so much to what you're saying about Jen, of like, she was, you know, in from another angle, she was this bud about to open and all this stuff was about to happen, and she left us at that point.
Yeah.
So coming back to that kind of time when you're all wrapped up and you're inside and you're not, you know, you're not exploring the world in the same way.
Yeah.
Must be very evocative.
Definitely.
Very evocative. And I think, you know, everyone experiences the anniversary so differently, and some people don't even notice it, but like, whatever works for you, like if monitoring it, marking it, feeling it, noticing the sun, if that is important to you, that's like your journey with remembering her. And all you can do is go, well, this works for me.
Yeah.
Like, and someone else in a similar situation who's also lost someone to suicide would be like, oh God, no, I never think of it. I never remember it. Like, it's such, you know, your relationship to Jen was completely unique, and that's the way you will remember her and celebrate her and grieve her is completely unique. Isabel, I could talk to you for hours. thank you so much for talking to me and remembering Jen. She sounds brilliant. I would love to go see We Will Rock You with her. I was going to say, I feel like you should blast, like when you're feeling down, I feel like you should blast Queen Greatest Hits. It's such a, like, I don't even know the Greatest Hits album.
Yeah.
Because it's
familiar,
Queen.
Yeah.
It's such a good album. And I feel like if you're having that moment, like just like volume one Queen, just like blast it as loud as you can.
Oddly, just, like, on the second anniversary, I was away with my day job in Thailand, and I was in a bar, and I was just laughing with my friend about something, and then Radio Gaga came on.
Aww.
And it was on the anniversary, and I was like, oh, you've just come in to remind me that you're... okay, yeah. Like, and then I had a big cry, and I had to go home. But I was like, oh, yeah, like, I know. I'm not having fun on your anniversary, Jen, right?
Like. Yeah, don't forget. Yeah, I think that's nice to have something
that
you can hold. But yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You can follow Isabel on Twitter at irresponsible. That's at IRRESPONSABELLE. She's on Twitter at irresponsible and Instagram at irresponsible. And you can head to her website, isabelfarah.com, one R, for more information on where she's gigging and where you can see her brilliant shows. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely in both our living room and kitchen, I think. It was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. Artwork by Jade Perkin, and is there anything else? No, that's the usual things I have to tell you. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.